Hello. Oh, I'm so glad to be back here. I didn't know 20 years ago when Hans invited me to come here that we would be doing this 20 years later, but it's been a pleasant experience. I found this when I was packing. Some of you may remember this from 4 years ago. So luckily we don't need that now. One thing I'm glad about is I'm speaking early, so I get to relax for the rest of the conference. Sometimes I stress out about these things. I try to time them out too much, and I realize that if I go long, I'll just do part two on my podcast, so you can check it later, so I'm not too worried about it. Today's topic is, the title is Where the Common Law Goes Wrong, and this is revisiting an issue I've mentioned here in a couple of previous years. In 2012 that I spoke and recorded it, it was about a similar topic. And back in 2021, I spoke on something somewhat related, but had a lot more thoughts since then. And that's what today's talk is about, sort of as a companion to Sean's talk about the Roman law as well, because I'm talking about the Roman law and the common law. I was working out with my trainer. As you can tell, I'm very fit and buff. And I've been with her for 15 years, and she's a little bit tired of hearing my talks about libertarianism and Austrian economics by now, but I always rehearse to her what I'm going to do, and I was telling her about the common law, and she says, what's that? She says, isn't that common law marriage? So she had no idea. She says, you need to explain these things to people. Don't assume everyone thinks about the Roman law every day, like the current meme. So I figured, I'll try to start from some basics, and also Renata always reminds me to speak slowly, so I'm going to try to do that. So just some basics. So I'm going to talk about the common law, and my title sounds like I'm criticizing the common law, where it goes wrong, but it's not really a criticism of the common law. It's how to orient and think about it. So when I say the common law, that's a type of law. And what is law itself? So law in general is a word that we use to refer to regularity of events, right? So we have different types of laws that we're used to, speaking of causal laws, like the laws of cause and effect, or physics laws, law of gravity, economic laws, laws of logic. Then we also have, these are descriptive laws. They describe the way the world works. We also have normative laws, right? Moral laws, narrow codes of ethics, like for doctors and lawyers. And then we have the legal laws, or legislation, or jurisprudence. And this is a blend of normative and descriptive laws. It's normative in that laws are designed to guide us in what we should be doing in life, right? Just like morals are designed to tell us how we should act in life, there's a normative aspect to laws. But there's also a descriptive aspect, because they describe what will happen to you if you disobey the law, right? So legal laws, which is what most people mean by the word law, is a blend of normative and descriptive laws, okay? But we also, when you think about it this way, you recognize as libertarians that we criticize laws all the time as being wrong or bad or unjust. But when we do that, we recognize the ability to identify a law as existing in society without recognizing that it's just. So we can identify something as a law. We can say that is a law, but it's a bad law, right? So we are able to distinguish between just law and unjust law, right? Now, as I'll get to later, most people in today's world, even among libertarians, are used to thinking of law, that is legal law, as statutes or as words written down on paper that are issued by decrees of a government, like a legislature or a Congress, okay? For example, even in the libertarian movement or the common law movement, these income tax protesters, like in the United States, the ones who say that the income tax in America is voluntary and that you don't have to pay it, so you don't have to. It's up to you whether to pay it, because sometimes the IRS commissioner will say, we have a voluntary system. They'll say things like that. So they'll say something like, well, it's not illegal to evade taxes. It's not mandatory to pay taxes. And if you say, yes, it is, they'll say, show me the law. Now, when they say, show me the law, they're thinking of law as a written statute that they want you to point to prove what the law is. And that's because they're used to thinking of law as commands of the legislature, okay? But law was not always thought of as as legislation. This is a relatively recent phenomenon which has corrupted our thinking of what law is. The law actually emerged, the private law, things we're used to, contracts, family law, property rights, criminal law, torts, it emerged organically and gradually over a long periods of time in human history, primarily with the Roman law, from about 500 BC roughly to 565 AD, the end of Justinian's reign, and the common law, the English common law, from about 1066, the time of the Norman conquest, to the present. So each about 1,000 year periods where law was developed in decentralized form, right? Decentralized form because they were both roughly court-based systems where people with disputes would come to a judge to hear their case, and the judge would make a decision based upon previous law, and the law would develop in that way. Now, luckily for us, at the end of the Roman Empire, under Justinian, he ordered the Justinian's Code to be compiled, which was the compilation of all the existing Roman law to that point, and that is what helped preserve it and help in its rediscovery centuries later. In the meantime, after the fall of Rome, in Western Europe, law was mostly, after the Roman law was mostly lost for quite some time, law developed in Europe under Germanic customary laws like the Salic and Lombard and Visigothic laws, canon law of the Catholic Church, and local feudal customs and statutes. In 1070, a complete copy of the Justinian's Digest was found in Bologna, Italy, and it started being studied, and so in the 11th to the 15th centuries, there was the reception of the Roman law back into the law of Europe. And then with the rise of Enlightenment rationalism in the early 1800s with Napoleon's Code, there was a modern codification movement where the previous Roman law plus the European customary law were codified into beautiful or elegant civil codes. Now, they were also legislated by the legislature, which sort of made them a blend of legal positivism or legislated-based law, but also the content of the law was largely based upon the Roman law previously. So in today's world, the positive law systems, that is the law that the states enforce, is largely the European civil law systems and also in Latin America and the Anglo-American countries, the UK and the Commonwealth and the United States. They both basically embody private law, a core of private law that were developed each in largely decentralized court-based systems over 1,000 year periods of development, and the Roman law and the Anglo-American common law. But what happened was, after the decline of the ancient regime in France in 1789 and the collapse of monarchies after World War I and the emergence of democracy and the rise of the scientific central planning and the emergence of bureaucracies, there was an explosion of regulation and legislation, which starting in the early 1900s has gradually crowded out the field and the domain of the private law systems. So the civil codes of Europe and the common law of the United States and England has gradually been crowded out by legislation, leading to the modern habit, even among libertarians, of thinking of law as statutes or legislation. Okay. Now, one interesting thing to note is that probably because the predominance of scholars, free market thinkers in the mid-1900s to present were Anglo-American and English-speaking and thus familiar with the English common law system and the American common law system, most of the study of private law was more common law-based than Roman law-based. Okay, so you even had scholars like Leone, who was not American, and Hayek, the Chicago Law and Economics scholars, and studying spontaneous order and looking at the American and the English common law as an example of a spontaneous order, an unplanned order where law can emerge in a spontaneous fashion without planning. So, but without paying a lot of attention to the Roman law's similar decentralized attributes. Okay, and then you even have some people, because the civil codes in Europe, they are legislated, but they were legislated codifications of decentralized Roman law principles. But because they're legislated, that gave rise to the idea of legislative positivism, the idea that law comes from the legislature. And because of this, a lot of people that are critics of legal positivism and centralized planning erroneously attribute to the civil codes of Europe the idea of totalitarian systems, which is that everything that is not permitted by law is forbidden, right? Which is just not true. That is true of totalitarian systems, but it is not true of a civil code-based system. Just because it's legislated doesn't mean that the default is that you have to have permission from the government to act. It is true that in France and European countries, they tend to be more socialistic, but it's not because they have civil codes, it's because of other legislation that is encroached upon those fields. Okay, so, and Professor Hoppe himself interestingly noted this, I think, in his Democracy book. He noted that a little side remark, I'm quoting Hans now, in English-speaking countries, there's a certain amount of pride in having the so-called common law, which is in a way non-codified case law. The continental tradition has been for a long time different. There we have codified law. Anglo-Saxons look down on codified law and hail their non-codified common law. I want to remark that Max Weber had this very interesting observation regarding this. He sees the reason for non-codification of the common law in the self-interest of the lawyers to make the law difficult to understand for the layman and thus make lots of money. Okay. So in other words, the benefit of having a written civil code in Europe is that the layman can understand it. It's not because it's legislated, it's because it is a codification of principles. Okay, so as Hans concludes, maybe this excessive pride the Anglo-Saxons have in their common law might be a little bit overdrawn. Now, in any case, in my view, as a libertarian, from a libertarian point of view, what we libertarians, when we point to private law, we need to keep in mind, or have in mind, both the Roman law or the civil law of Europe and the Anglo-American common law. Now, why does this matter? It matters because libertarians have this tendency to have a naive or rationalistic approach of libertarian law as being designed top-down by thinkers. This is why libertarians obsess with lifeboat scenarios and would you push the button, like would you push a button to have anarchy tomorrow if you could, or armchair theorizing, right? So even like Rothbard himself veered a little bit in this direction. Because he was such a pioneer and he was expected to answer so many things, he started answering questions like, what would you do in this case? What would you do in this case? From his armchair. So as he wrote, while this book establishes the general outlines of a system of libertarian law, however, it is only an outline or prolegomena to what I hope will be a fully developed libertarian law code. So you see, he had in mind this idea that some libertarians could write down a law code, okay? A law code of the future. Hopefully, libertarian jurists and legal theorists will arise to hammer out the system of libertarian law in detail, for such a law code will be necessary to the truly successful functioning of what we may hope will be the libertarian society of the future. So Rothbard, of course, is correct that to have a free society and a libertarian society, it would largely embody and respect libertarian rights and libertarian laws. But he has this idea that someone's going to hammer out a legal code, like a civil code, which is like the Louisiana or the French civil code, which has been purified of its defects and just made to be perfect. Sort of like the image we have in the end of Atlas Shrugged, where in Galt's Gulch, Judge Narragansett is taking the United States Constitution and he's just slightly crossing out a few little mistakes, right, to make this perfect document to govern a free society. But the problem with the idea of designing a libertarian law code is it leaves out context. There is a limit to deductive reasoning. And like the Randians, the objectivists have a point when they criticize some each other and some libertarians for excessive rationalism, which some of them, of course, suffer from excessive rationalism. And of course, some of the Austrian critics like Meek from Mises and Hayek to Rothbard and Hoppe, they've criticized scientism, which is related to this, and like Hayek criticized constructive rationalism, right? The idea that we can, with our minds, plan too much, plan the economy, plan what the law is. But the essential point we have to keep in mind is that context matters, and there are always limits to armchair reasoning. This matters because what law is it's a practical discipline, it's an institution where property rights emerge as a normative response to the problem of conflict and disputes in a world of scarcity. This is one reason law did emerge as a over two separate 1,000-year or millennia-long periods, gradually by judges hearing real cases between actual parties having a real dispute over some real resource. And in those cases, what a judge can do is he can take evidence and testimony. They can take into account relevant evidence, customs, and context. And we also must remember that libertarianism as a modern discipline is a relatively young philosophy, only about 70 years old. So we can't expect it to be fully formed yet. Okay, so what is the task of libertarian law, given this background? So we, again, keep in mind, it would be futile for someone to sit down and to try to write, say, a libertarian constitution. Why is that? Which I've tried, by the way, for Liberland, we looked at a constitution. The problem with the constitution is it's just a statist document. A constitution means to constitute or make up or to create a government. So that's not what is, a libertarian constitution is a contradiction in terms. So what about a libertarian law code itself? Well, it would be futile to try to write a libertarian law code for a couple of reasons. Well, number one, it's premature. I mean, if I wrote it tomorrow, no, there's no court that's going to hear it because courts are statist courts applying state law. So it would be sort of a futile or pointless exercise. But it would also be impossible. It'd be impossible to write it because law just doesn't develop that way. The only way to do that would be to throw everything away and start from scratch, right? Which would be extremely rationalistic and it would be unwise to throw out the accumulated wisdom that has been developed in 2,000-year periods of judges trying to do justice in cases over 2,000 years of experience. Let me read a quote from G.K. Chesterton. He wrote, "In the matter of reforming things as distinct from deforming them, there is one plain and simple principle, a principle which will probably be called a paradox. There exists in such a case a certain institution or law, let us say for the sake of simplicity, a fence or gate erected across a road. The more modern type of reformer goes gaily up to it and says, I don't see the use of this, let us clear it away. To which the more intelligent type of reformer will do well to answer, if you don't see the use of it, I certainly won't let you clear it away. Go away and think. Then you can come back and tell me what you do see the use of it, and then I may allow you to destroy it." Right? So what's the point of that? The point of that is, There could be private law developed in the Roman law or the English law that is actually unjust and incompatible with libertarian principles. There could be, and there are. But we don't just assume that. In fact, we would assume the other, right? So the role of libertarian scholars and thinkers is to carefully justify, elaborate, and clearly set out our principles, right? So as for the former, for setting them out, that's what libertarian thinkers have been doing for a good 50, 70 years. People like Rothbard and especially Hoppe, in my view, as the pinnacle of modern legal scholarship. And it's what I've tried to do based upon their work in the last 33 years of my writing as encapsulated in my book, which I published 2 years ago here. And as for the latter, for setting out our principles, I think we've reached a point 70 years into this endeavor where we have a good enough grasp of our basic principles to write them down in a systematic, clear formulation, which I recently tried to do just a couple of weeks ago, and with the collaboration of Alessandro and David Durr, and Professor Hoppe, and Max, who's also here. And I published something called The Universal Principles of Liberty. It's only a couple of pages long, and it's just an encapsulation of what we view as the libertarian conception of libertarian rights, property rights, and principles of justice. But this is not a complete law code and never could be a complete law code. The idea is that jurists of the future could refer to these principles in their reasoning and in their decisions. They would draw as a starting point from the Roman law and the common law, but only insofar as these principles were compatible with core libertarian principles. So they would look at the Roman law and the common law as a starting point, maybe with a presumption of validity, but subject to challenge in light of consistency with foundational libertarian principles. And keeping in mind Chesterton's admonition not to cast away something until you're sure why it was erected in the first place. Now, Rothbard was actually close to this kind of way of looking at it when he goes on from the quote I had read earlier. He says, "There exists another alternative for law and society, an alternative not only to administrative decree or statutory legislation, but even to judge-made law. That alternative is the libertarian law, based upon the criteria that violence may be used only against those who initiate violence. In practice, so this, he says, in practice, this means taking the largely libertarian common law, he could have also mentioned the Roman law, but the largely libertarian common law, and correcting it by the use of man's reason. Now, here I agree with them. I agree with them so far. We can take that as a starting point and correct it with our reason when it's inconsistent with libertarian principles. But then he writes, before enshrining it as a permanently fixed libertarian code or constitution. So that's getting to this idea. It's never going to be fixed. It's going to be a developing, organic body of law. So what we could expect in a future libertarian society, which we don't have yet, is advocates on both sides of a dispute to argue for their client's case before the judge, appealing to general libertarian principles and the body of private law that the court adopts, whether Roman law or common law, and then it would develop that way. Now, this implies that when we look at, that you can expect judges to look at the common law or the Roman law and take it as an inspiration or a starting point when there's a dispute, and you could imagine in a free society the law developing that way going forward. Like, you start with libertarian principles to the extent they're compatible with Roman law or common law, and the judge would confer with that, and then over time you'd have libertarian law gradually develop, and then over time more and more judges would refer to the growing body of libertarian law, and the common law and the Roman law would become less and less important over time, but this would be a gradual, probably centuries long or decades long process. But this does imply that I think we do have enough wisdom at this point, knowing what we know about libertarian principles, to say that there are some parts of the common law and the Roman law which are actually unlibertarian and should be rejected already from the outset. We can already say that. We don't have to wait. And there are some parts of the Roman law and the common law which are ingenious and which we should preserve. So in my remaining time, how much time do I have, Hans? 5? I'm not going to argue for these positions here, but I've written on them, and let me just go through a list of some things that I think where the common law is wrong, and if I were a judge in the new libertarian system, I would stick with libertarian principles and reject these aspects of common law because I think they are not compatible with libertarian law. One would be, and this is something Sean and I argued about last night because Sean is more of a fan of the common law than I am, but consideration in contract, the idea that for a contract to be binding, you need to give something of value to the other party. That's consideration. This is why in American contracts or English contracts, we often say, I pay you $1 or $10 consideration, and you don't even pay it. It's just a formality on the paper. The Roman law doesn't have that requirement, and I think it's not needed. So, blackmail law, I think. Libertarians have argued why blackmail law is unjust, but that's a part of the common law. Trademark law and defamation law, which are both based upon the erroneous concept of reputation rights, trade secret law, common law copyright, slavery, of course, coverture. Roberto Medina suggested that example to me, the idea that married women don't have private property rights, primogeniture. So there are some aspects of the common law which I think are clearly unlibertarian. Now, there are some solutions of the common law and the Roman law which are just brilliant and reflect the wisdom of accumulated knowledge that comes in these decentralized systems. You know, the idea of mens rea, the idea of joint and several liability. There's something in the law called the felony murder rule, right, which is the idea that if you have a crime like murder, like if you're committing a bank robbery and someone is killed during that, then you can presume that it was first degree murder. There's an interesting example in the law where the law says to be responsible for harm to someone, you have to be the cause, which makes sense. And so a test was developed called the but-for cause, which means you're only responsible, approximately responsible for an injury if you were the but-for cause, which meaning but for your action, the damage wouldn't have happened. But the problem with that test is that you could imagine a case of two equal and independent actors who harm an innocent victim. Like, let's say you have two hunters in the woods, they don't even know each other, and they both shoot at the same time, and they both miss, and they hit some guy in the woods, right? And they both kill this guy, or the guy's killed. He's struck by two bullets and dies. either one could get off of liability by saying that neither one is a but-for cause, because it's not true that but for my shooting, the victim would have died because the other guy was shooting. But they could both make that argument, and that would give them immunity from liability. So the common law says no. In that case, we're going to sort of group around these guys and treat them as if they're acting together, even though they're not, and hold them liable anyway. So there are solutions like that in the common law, which are brilliant. So the general point is that if we're ever to be so fortunate as to have a free society where we're starting from scratch and we have judges trying to do justice, trying to apply libertarian principles, they would and should and can be expected to refer to existing bodies of private law, namely the common law as embodied in, say, the restatements of the law, the American Law Institute, or the European civil codes like the French civil code or the German civil code or the Swiss civil code or the Greek or the Louisiana, and use it as starting points, but being ready to reject their provisions that are incompatible with liberty. Thank you very much.